Oh, make me over. I'm all I wanna be. A walking study.
Melissa Auftemauer came of age during one of the most volatile and creative eras in modern rock. The Canadian-born musician first emerged from Montreal's thriving art scene before stepping onto a much larger stage as the bassist for the band Hole during the mid-1990s, and later as a touring member of the Smashing Pumpkins. Along the way, she built a multifaceted career as a solo artist, photographer, and cultural curator. In her new memoir, which is just stunning, Even the Good Girls Will Cry, a 90s rock memoir, Auftemauer looks back at the defining decade of alternative music with candor and reflection. The book traces her journey from a bohemian upbringing in Montreal and early encounters with bands like Nirvana and Sonic Youth to the whirlwind of touring creativity and, yes, grief that shaped the 90s rock scene. It is part coming-of-age story, part backstage chronicle of the alternative era. The memoir captures a generation's artistic energy and the complicated realities behind the music. It's both a personal narrative and a vivid portrait of a moment when rock culture felt raw, immediate, and transformative. The book is just out today, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Melissa Auftemauer to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
Happy St. Patrick's Day, you and all the listeners.
Well, not only is it St. Patrick's Day and the book release day, it's your birthday.
It's true. Yes. I mean, it was a sweet bonus that the publishers decided to shift my book day to my birthday. I'm grateful. And I am so happy to be back up here. It's been a while. I've missed you, WAMC, and I'm still a Hudson Valley thriving resident, but I time traveled and now I'm going beyond the valley to other places with this book.
One time you and I met on a train coming back from the city, and we were talking, and I remember you leaving and getting off in Hudson and me thinking to myself, man, I bet she has a ton of stories. And boy, do you. At what point did you think, okay, this is something I would like to chronicle? Because you've always, you journaled, you took pictures. Yeah. I mean, you were chronicling it in a way.
Well, actually, obsessively. Yeah, and I try to capture that. Part of my instinct in this book is that I was photographing and journaling daily, reflecting on what I could tell was historic proportions in rock, but also my own life. The change when I joined those bands was so overwhelming, and the life that a band like that lives in that a moment of time like that, I knew that I wouldn't really be able to unpack it till later. So I was sort of logging all this information. And when I sat down to write this book just a few years ago, it only took me a couple of years to write, but it was as I was approaching my 50th birthday and my daughter was about to turn 10. I just had this sort of revelation of like a big clock of decades going of it's time for me to look back, unpack it, heal through it, celebrate it, find the hidden treasures and the hidden pains so that I can be a better mother, actually. A lot of it was just, let me just move on from the 90s so I can move into my 50s and have a daughter who becomes a teenager and be present. It's a love letter to my generation and to music, but it's also just so I can be a well-rounded human being. Yeah.
The subtitle of the book is a 90s rock memoir, and while you do chronicle the early years of your life, very much focused on that time and the profound impact it had on you, obviously.
And, I mean, and my generation. It really, right. Like, I took that bite size, 91 to 2001, the decade that defined me and my generation, and I use my story as the deeply personal lens to maybe hopefully shed light and uncover what everyone's story was at that time. We were shifting as a society, and our generation of visceral music, I think, is a symbol of what we were preparing for, which is the 21st century and the brave new world and everything that has happened and how did we get here. I'm hoping that by unpacking a bit of my tiny story in that one decade, the last analog decade of our society, that we might find treasures, gems, and answers to how we got into here, but how we can make a more livable future.
We mentioned that it's your birthday today, which means that you are a Pisces.
Yes.
You write in the book, Pisces represents the end of the life cycle, connecting the material world to the afterlife and divine. The sign is symbolized by two fish tied to each other's tails, one swimming upstream and the other downstream. This duality would come to define me even more than the narratives and details of my mortal life. I have always been torn between the mortal and the ethereal sides of myself. How to live on both sides? This inner conflict has always defined me, and I was beginning to believe it defined my generation.
Thank you for reading that poetic thing to me. Thank you, because I'm about to go on my book tour, and I have to decide what to read. And that's an example of a paragraph I'd like to pull more often, and thank you for picking up on it. Because, you know, maybe I'm just a mapper and I'm trying to figure, but there was something about that conflict and that sort of inner both sides of me that I began to see as a reflection of that turn of the millennium and a end of life as we know it, and the next, here we are. Yeah,
right.
Thank you for pulling that out.
As you go on, you talk about growing up in Montreal, and you talk about your larger-than-life father and the relationship that you have with your mother, of course. But then there's the musical aspect of you and going to clubs and hearing the music and being obsessed by the music and that being a driving influence. But then there's also that, as we get into the story, as we get into your career, of you always sort of being on the periphery.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, insider, outsider, and, you know, in even just like in feminist theory or art history theory of feminists, the other, right? So the other perspective,
right.
I feel like whether it's because I'm born Canadian with dual citizenship, jumped into an American thing, or I'm a redhead, which is kind of normal, but just a little bit alien, or I'm a bass player, I'm kind of center, but side stage, I'm always sort of in the inside outside position. And it seems to be a reoccurring theme for me and a reoccurring thing I learn from, of the toggling in and out of something and giving me a, I guess, almost more holistic perspective on a situation. And even for those who don't know my history, but when I joined the big rock band, I was replacing a deceased person. And then when I joined the second big rock band, I was replacing a MIA disappeared person. And I just seem to be always the outsider that's coming into something with a new perspective in many cases. And I always credit this as my like redhead Canadian good girl side. I bring a sort of light to the situation. It, you know, it's not hard when joining whole, which I refer to as like the abyss. It was death, drugs, addiction, power, fame, scrutiny from the media, misogyny, burning my band member Courtney Love at the stake like a witch. I mean, it was very easy to be light and very essential for me to be on the outside, to not get completely sucked into the chaos, which was whole in the wake of Kurt's death and in the wake of the bass player Kristen's death. You know, so I had to protect myself by remaining an outsider in a way.
4 months after his death is when you enter the band,
yeah,
which is significant culturally, but of course significant in the fact that Courtney Love is very much a grieving widow at this point who wants to go on with her career. And to walk into that is just, that's a lot.
A single mother of a 2-year-old who has been abandoned by their father. And to live in a society where 30 years later, I still see Kurt as the, you know, messiah of our generation, and every Urban Outfitters, every kid who's never even heard Nirvana. Nirvana is everywhere. What happened to the widow? What happened to the daughter? What happened to the women he left behind? A big part of this book is not to tear down Nirvana, but it's the question of, does anybody wonder? yes, was she a difficult, challenging person? And she, you know, built her reputation on that. But she was also a grieving, mentally unstable, drug addicted, single mother. And I had a very unique perspective by being right to her right of the stage and watching the way media, other peers, audience members throwing shotgun shells at her. I mean, the violent nature of being witness to how the world treated that woman, and that it's a miracle she's alive. We're closer than we've ever been. She's in her 60s. She's releasing a new record this year. I'm so proud of her. I am here to stand by her side as I was when I was 22 and joined her band, aware that it was going to be hell and that I witnessed hell, and it was her hell. She was living in hell, and no one really helped. It was kind of amazing. The only ones that really hold the legacy of that band in their hearts purely are the young kids who are moved by her music and moved by what that band has become. But it really lives in a very still underground. She has not been given her due. She is not, you know, Hole is not even near to a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, nomination. These are all things that I, as a woman, not as a bass player of Hole only, but as a woman who is chronicling women in art, women in culture. Remember, we barely had the right to vote 100 years ago. My mother probably barely had a credit card in the 60s. Like, give me a break. We have not come very far, women, and I'm here to remind people it's still an ongoing story.
It certainly is. Melissa Aftabauer is our guest, and the new book is Even the Good Girls Will Cry. One of the fascinating things of what you just mentioned is that you are joining a group that is predominantly women. And you would think then, and it was one of the, it seemed to be one of the things that attracted you to the idea that you were going to be a musician in a band that was
yes,
female.
Yes, in fact, the chaos and the drugs and the death and the sadness was what I did not want to do. But then it was a higher calling when I realized joining an army of women trying to make an impact on a male-dominated landscape, which is the history of rock music at this point. So it was very much a cultural commitment that I made to open the doors for women of the future to be more readily accepted into the leading powers of music business. And Hole, as much as I'm complaining that the legacy isn't as big as Nirvana, even though they had the exact same amount of records, the exact same amount of hits, and many, you know, yes, Nirvana broke that, you know, broke the big 90s grunge moment. They were the pioneers, but Hole was the most successful female rock band in the 90s. Like, there was not another female rock band that was nominated for that many Grammys and who sold that many records and left a mark. So we've made the history books, but it's more that the blinders of a lot of media and cultural makers, I feel like it's really coming around now. And there's, like, finally an awareness of what was done to her was not fair and that she is due. You know, and I speak, again, as an outsider, insider, you know, like, do I want the years that I devoted to that band to be also celebrated? Yes, but it's bigger than me. It's beyond me. It's just trying to get it right for women in general.
You tell these stories, and sometimes I would lose track. You would tell these stories, and you would talk about times and tours and moments and albums and things that happened. And then you would say, I was 22 years old, or I was 20 years old, or I was 21. My God. I mean, that is very young to be witnessing that type of abyss, but chaos.
Yeah, and obviously I give the front of the book really is an ode to my incredible counterculture pioneering parents and the amazing city of Montreal I grew up in. So the reason why it's so important for me to establish my origin story at the beginning of the book is how unique my upbringing was.
Right.
My mother was a radical feminist single mother. My father came in later. I had a very progressive for the time, especially still actually to these, like, it was a progressive upbringing.
Never married. They were one night stand.
Yeah. Well, they did get married later, which is a weird thing for 6 months. So it's all very, like, you know, it's very progressive for the time. And I credit that for why it was so easy for me to step into this insane. I also, as you mentioned, my father, for anyone who reads the book, even if they've never heard of Nick Aftermore, my father, you walk away from the book very charmed by my, He started in radio, then he had his own TV shows, then he started as a copy boy at the Montreal Gazette and worked till the day he died at this newspaper as a columnist. People called him the Jimmy Breslin of Montreal. He is a true chronicler of the city of Montreal for decades upon decades. And I grew up in his shadow as a public figure, so I was kind of ready for this.
I love that you included things that he wrote throughout the book, including things that he wrote about you and his experiences with you and with the band. But as you said, this was a guy upon his passing. That church was packed, and they were outside the door, and this was a much loved man who had his flaws,
lived in conflict, died at the age I am turning on Tuesday, way too young, and he was an addict, but he was a very, very, I always said, very happy drunk. I always sort of, protect, because it wasn't a dark thing. It was just, I saw the addiction of his smoking and drinking, which took his life very early. I grew up in bars. He ran his campaigns out of bars. He ran downtown Montreal as a man of the people. He was very accessible. His phone number was always listed. He, was friends with the nuns, the drug dealers in jail. He helped everybody. He just was a true humanitarian who put that all into politics and journalism. And he, we need more of him now in the world. He was a dying breed then, and he's got a street named after him, and it was the biggest funeral in Montreal history because he gave himself to a people and to a place. And I realize when people ask, how I wrote this book as a musician, photographer, I because of my father's, he chronicled my upbringing and my city and the history of our city, and I really grew up in a narrative, and I realized when I wrote this, I was able to channel a lot of my father's storytelling.
It tells us something that you didn't call him Dad, you called him Nick.
Yeah, I didn't meet him till I was 2, and then he moved in next door when I was 4, and it was like a nice man who entered my life. And he was a very cool guy, but he was never supposed to be like a husband or a father. He was just like a mentor a bit to me or something.
And one day, you took the cigarettes away.
Yes, and that was the only time my father ever got mad, and that's when I saw the look in his eyes of there's something wrong with this addiction, because I'm calling him on it, and he looked at me with like that was a line I could never cross again. I threw them into the sewer, and he just looked at me and, Melissa, never do that again. And that's when I saw his scary side of, oh, this is a non-negotiable for him. He will smoke till he dies, and he died of smoking.
Yeah. The music scene at the time, there is a Zelig-like quality to the book where even though you're in Montreal, the creme de la creme of the musicians that you're following are there.
Yeah.
And you're meeting them. And you're not only meeting them, you are communicating with them. You are
Connecting and bonding
and going backstage, and some of your stories of how you got backstage are great. Mm-hmm. And there you are. And that is, first of all, what a gift, but also, especially because of your love of the music. I mean, it's not just a fandom. No. That's an excitement about the music that they were creating.
It was a calling. I actually felt a call to arms for my generation when I started. Those bands that we're talking about, Hole, the Smashing Pumpkins, I saw them on their first ever tours of ever anywhere, so in front of 20 people. When I met Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins, he was playing to 20 unappreciative people, but I was the person who became the fan in the audience and introduced myself and had a lifelong connection with him.
That connection for you, you write in the book, with Billy was instantaneous.
Instant. I mean, it was as if he awakened the sounds of my insides and I found my calling. And I hadn't even played music. I didn't play bass at that point. I decided upon being introduced to that band on a $1 Tuesday night at a little punk club. I walked up to him. I said, I'm going to follow you to the end of time. But like, who are you? I want to be friends with you. And I ended up joining his band 10 years later.
And he sensed that. I mean, he predicted that.
He did. Yeah. And then I just was on his podcast. It came out last week. And we interview each other about those early, his and her version of the memory of the time I go up to him and introduce myself. And the sort of rest is our rock destiny together. But yes, I mean, I have I'm sure you picked up, even you read the passage about astrology in there, and about, but I also weave my dreamscapes throughout the book, and there's really big interventions that almost felt like premonitions, and when I was 19, that kind of pushed me towards music, and it felt like there was a force beyond this lifetime that was encouraging me to follow my dreams, quite literally my dreams, but also the music that made me feel alive.
I thought that was something that I wanted to ask you about. I had put it down in my notes because the dream, those dreamscapes are so vivid. And as you said, there is a difference between a dream and a premonition.
Yeah.
But to identify that is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I write about it in the book. I grew up with very political, intellectual, academic, intelligent parents, very, politically active. And I had this moment when I was a teenager when I started getting these very vivid dreams and very science fiction, things that I hadn't watched a science fiction film. It felt like messages from elsewhere, mm-hmm. and I was actually terrified. I wasn't like looking for haunting things. It just sort of started, it was like something on the other side was knocking on the door, and it changed the way I looked at life. And I started listening and picking up on cues in these dreams. And they basically told me to make music my life, that there was a calling and a place for me in my generation. And you have to read the book to not think that I'm a total flake here, what I'm telling you, because even when I was writing the book, I was telling my editor, I do not want to lose people here. I don't want to start sounding like some wild hippie saying that my dreams told me. But the fact is, the dreams did tell me something, and I listened. And it took me years to even sort of acknowledge how that affected my life decisions.
But I don't want it to be lost in our conversation that you just touched on it, but some of these dreams are frightening.
Terrifying. That's
just
why it's like
terrifying.
Terrifying. The title of the book was given to me by what I can only describe as a demon when I was 19, whispering in my ears in my bedroom, that even the good girls will cry. I awoke with a strange, like almost ghostly figure whispering in my ear. And I did not ever write that dream down till I finished writing this entire book. I had been so terrified of that dream my whole life. I never even had it. It was burned in my memory. And when I sat down to write it for the book, at the end of writing the entire book, I realized this is the title of the book, and I'm going to start the book with this dream. I had never really known what to make of it. And the editors and publishers, we had been working with a different title of the book, and at the very end, when I was submitting the entire final manuscript, I had that at the top, and I said, I've changed the title. And they had warned me, it's already booked in, we already have the other title, and there wasn't even a debate. They said, that's a better title, thank you. Mm. So truly, a demon, like, that was given to me by a demon. That's all I can tell you. I didn't want a demon to talk to me. I didn't want scary things happening to me, but they happened.
Tinker was your first band. And how formative was that for you?
I mean, the joke is, to give people perspective, yes, I was only 22 when I joined a giant rock band. But the more specific thing about the 22-year-old is I had only been playing bass for about a year, and I had only played 6 rock shows when I joined Hole, and my first show was in front of 65,000 people in England at the biggest festival there.
The Reading Festival.
So, I mean, it just does such a ridiculous, Through the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland. I'm just like, joined another dimension. I went from a tiny local, tiny band where we truly had been together less than a year, and then I was in Hole. So that's a very strange A to Z psychedelic portal. No one really rides that trajectory usually. Very unique.
We're going to pause. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll talk about your meeting of Courtney Love and how that eventually ended up with you joining the band, and much, much more. Melissa Aftemauer is our guest. The name of the new book is Even the Good Girls Will Cry, a 90s rock memoir, and we'll continue our conversation after this short break.
I am
For fans of 1990s alternative rock, Melissa Auftemar was often right at the center of the storm. The Montreal-born bassist joined Hole in 1994 and later toured with the Smashing Pumpkins, helping shape the sound and mythology of a defining musical decade. She's the author of the new book, Even the Good Girls Will Cry, a 90s rock memoir, and it's wonderful to have her here. Prior to you going into the band, you mentioned before the break about having not much experience and then going in and then playing this huge Reading Festival, but you had met Courtney prior to that.
Yep. Again, you know, everything happened very quickly in this, but in the summer of 1991, which, to remind people, never mind the big, like, changing, the turning of the tide, that was in fall of 91, Nirvana became the biggest rock band in America, right? And kind of took over where the 80s, like, the 80s disappeared, and all of a sudden we were in the 90s. But in the summer of 91, all in the course of about a week, I saw two tiny, tiny unknown bands, Hole and the Smashing Pumpkins, on separate occasions. But I did have the opportunity, because I worked as a ticket girl. I was already working in the music industry from the age of 15 or 16. Quebec is quite liberal in their bar policies. So I was working as a ticket girl and I was working as a cassette DJ at this other bar. And I was just in the mix at shows every night. And I will never forget. And I, of course, tell the story vividly when I walked in on a set, which is Hole, fronted by Courtney Love. I had never seen a force, a female force. And I had been going to shows already at that point for a few years. And I was obsessed with the music of the 80s. And I knew underground music, but I had never seen a woman like summon the depths of hell onto a stage with such a command over her band, her audience. She was playing in front of 20 people, but she was roaring at the universe in a way. It was so shocking. She made an impression. She was terrifying, a bit like the demons that I saw in my dreams. I mean, it was profound. And people were all in shock. Like, the, you know, Courtney did things, and still to this day, even when she was on the cover of every major magazine, she was still hard to understand. But she came out of the gate that way. And I love reframing her for people in this book, as she was so ahead of her time with female power in that way of just do everything they don't want you to do and get attention and get out there. And that's why people judged her of being, you know, too difficult or attention grabbing. But how else were we going to have a say? I wasn't, you know, I ended up being happy to be a support to her, but I wasn't going to be the one going out using, can I don't know what words I can say, bleep them if you can't, but bitch and whore. I mean, her, you know, she was turning feminism upside down through such a sophisticated format of loud rock music. And she was just beyond ahead of her time. And I saw it, and I'm so glad. I mean, and that's why I said no to join the band, is when I was asked a few years later, it just seems like terrifying. I can't go be in a band with that wild monster, even though I respect it. I'm glad I did, because now it's been a life-defining relationship. But she was scary and remarkable.
I guess as I was reading, I was thinking, you know, how much of that is an act? How much of that is a stage persona? And you make it very clear that there's no on and off switch there. That's her, and you say power, and I, yes, of course, but great anger as well.
Yes. And she, you know, I ended up being able to be a lot like my father was as a politician, a humanitarian, where I saw the unfair lens. We talked about it earlier. She was a widow. She was a drug addict. She was a single mother. That's enough to have a little compassion for this woman. But then if you know her backstory, as I discovered, she was essentially a product of a rape by two very unloving parents. She was emancipated from her family and living alone by 16, working as a stripper. What do you expect if you've never known love? And if you go backwards, three generations of adopted women put on literally church stoops and baskets. So if you don't know love, how do you expect to give love? And all this woman knew was rage, anger, sadness. And she has made that work for her in such an incredible way. The fact that she's alive, the fact that she turned it all into remarkable art that are feminist anthems of our generation. Play a snippet of Miss World or Doll Parts. I mean, just power. She turned it into power.
Yeah. They really want you. They really do.
I'm very clear in the book by the end of, now that you've seen this full portrait, do you have respect for her? And I believe the answer will be yes. And what is most honorable about this woman who was burned at the stake and accused of killing her husband and all these outrageous things, she never played the victim. She always had pride. She didn't look for sympathy. And I have compassion and sympathy for her because that's how strong she is.
I get senses, this is later in the relationship, but she's writing to you. You include the letters. In fact, you even have a picture of the facts. But she says, "Dear Melissa, I want to explain something to you that I know about beauty." And she's writing to you, and I'll get to some points here, but she says, "Don't get trapped by your beauty. You are so much more than beautiful. You will cause change and affect reality. Just give of your beauty. You know you have it. Be generous with it. Boys will want to marry you. Girls will want to be you. And whip out your mannequin stuff whenever you'd like. But don't be afraid of that goofy, funny part."
Mm-hmm.
Why did she feel compelled to write that to you?
So imagine at the time, this is 98. For those who may or may not know Hole, the most popular song, Malibu, is a top 40 hit. We're breaking mainstream at that point, right? And we are on the cover of every magazine, and we are invited to fashion shows and, you know, really mainstream beauty stuff. And all of a sudden we have stylists and hair and makeup and fashion shoots. And it was just, and I had already been cast. Sort of my role in the band was the good girl to the bad girl, the virgin to the whore. So, and I was, as she says in this letter, more traditionally beautiful. She was more of a handsome, you know, wild card. So I had sort of just been pushed into this role of the beautiful girl in the band. And even for the strongest person like me, when you just, I mean, imagine poor girls with social media now, but when you look, you see pictures of yourself all the time and you feel this pressure of feeling pretty and all the, and it was because at that moment I was being very much like courted by fashion designers and all, and I was very conflicted in it. And she, meanwhile, for people who can follow her career, was about to be, was becoming the biggest Hollywood movie star. She was nominated for Golden Globes.
End of the Moon.
Yeah, and People versus Larry Flint. Right. All of a sudden, she was this giant mainstream celebrity and on the cover of all the magazines doing Versace campaigns. So she was sort of like, at the time, I was so kind of broken by the horrific music industry that I had like a mistrust of her motives on this. But when I, luckily, that fax was fading to almost oblivion by the time I found it 20 years later and just scanned it quick to get it in the book. I cried when I read it 20 years later because she was actually, she's older than me. And I was significantly younger than a lot of these people in this generation. You know, I came in at the very tail end. And she was teaching me a thing about even me, the strong, embodied daughter of a feminist, was getting a little vapid and trapped. And not because I was superficial, but I truly was being, my life was being sucked out of me by just being pretty and being put in endless, it's hard to explain, but she knew something that I didn't, because she's a true, brilliant feminist, and I love that letter. Yes.
To have the fortitude, I'll use that word, to write you that letter, especially given her demons and what she had gone through.
Exactly. That's what I think. It's, I bring the readers on a long journey of many layers in this book. But when I'm in my reframing and re-sort of positioning Courtney as a feminist icon, by the time you get there and you've gone through like drug addiction, you've gone through terrible behavior. I don't, it's not all rosy. I talk about abscesses on her butt. I mean, that's not pretty. By the time we get to that and I let the reader discover her in her own words to me, you see the depth of complexity of this person, that she had this generosity of spirit for me. She could have been jealous. She could have been trying to manipulate me, all these things. She was actually looking out for me. And that's where you get to bring this person on a complicated journey of this, like, very generous of spirit letter. that she gives her younger bass player.
Obviously, drugs were so essential to this scene.
Mm-hmm.
They were a part of your mm-hmm. life, but addiction was not.
And I often say, and a lot of people who are in the program, which I'm not, but I have many, many friends, of course, recovering addicts, and many people in the partner program, Al-Anon, you know, I knew always that I was a daughter of an alcoholic. I've known that intuitively, even though there wasn't language for it, where in my environment,
right.
I knew I was a daughter of an addict and I should be careful. That also made me very perfectly compatible for addicts to hang out with because I'm non-judgmental. I accept people in their flaws, and the addicts were easy for me to accept, but I luckily don't have it in my DNA, or I was prepped to avoid it because of exposure to addiction, and I wasn't an addict. What?
Yes. No, I'm just curious because you'll snort the cocaine. Mm-hmm. You'll obviously psychedelics, mm-hmm. different.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. But
Coke's not cool.
No, Coke's not cool.
But that was Versace, okay?
But by, right.
But my no.
My point being is that you were one of very few that said, okay, now I'm done.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have an addictive personality. And I also had proper warning in seeing all the people like ruining their lives and dying. I mean, ruining. My best friend in the band, Patty, the drummer, we lost her to heroin addiction. She lived under a bridge for 5 years. Right. I mean, it's just insane.
Horrible.
Like what it does. Addiction does ruin. If you're not dead, you've ruined your life when you get that far, you know, and it's a miracle that I witnessed so many survivors out of that situation.
There's that aspect of it, the drug aspect. But then you start to turn on. Well, what's also interesting, I should note, is that you're in the band for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time, but not a
yep.
tremendously long time. And as that 5 years starts to turn around, you're like, okay, this is, I'm good.
Self-preservation kicked. I mean, I was always protecting myself through these sort of inside-outsider, arm's length, take pictures, write diary, pretend I'm not really in the band. I did a lot of protective measures, but by the end, yeah, the journey in the book is that when I learned that I know when it's enough and when I need to actually move on and away, and this is, you know, why 25 years later am I writing this book? Is a lot of it, I went running as fast as I could. Once I freed myself of the 90s and all of the, you know, beautiful, powerful, but very painful, you know, because it's not just the drugs. And it's like this corporate greed came in, started buying up all these bands. You know, some could say that Kurt committed suicide, not just because of addiction and depression, but that his cool alternative rock band had sort of turned them into like Pepsi Cola, you know, corporate consumption. And it was very difficult for people with integrity like us to live, feel okay with becoming these products of like these giant men in suits making money off of us. So there's a lot of that that happens in the book too, that explains what I think is a precursor of where we're living now, which is a, you know, a, like post-horrendous capitalism gone wrong of just like, what, tech companies buy our elections? How did this happen?
Well, it seems in the book, at the end, I mean, you leave us 2001, 2002 in the book, and it seems as though as you were making the calculations to get out of the active day-to-day of the business and the corporatization, that's exactly what you're predicting.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's why I left, and I could feel it, and that Y2K and 9/11 were the gateway of, oh no, here we go. This is going to be a different world. And yeah, that is why I end at that exact moment, because I could see what direction we were going in, because I say, and I do believe that our music moment and our generation, that decade of music, reflects that painful birth canal into what is now delivered us into a much more capitalistic society. And we were mourning it and mourning it all at the same time of like, this is going to change the way we all live. And the rise of Pro Tools and the way that people, iTunes, all these things began, you could see the precursor, and that our magic music was no longer going to be ours, and us in vans with, you know, just the power of the people is no longer. Now we have this like tech filter that like monitors and monetizes every second that any fan or musician spends on those like algorithms. Like we are really monitored and being mined for our time and our power.
Yes.
And children are too. And it's
we're
scary.
All being programmed.
Yeah.
as you come to say that you're done with Hole, and you include a letter that Courtney sent you that is just, I don't know how I would have taken it. And I know as I was reading it, because it is, it's so honest and it's harsh.
Mm-hmm.
It is, obviously part of this is that you have left Hole and you're going to work for, you're going to be in Billy Corgan's band Smashing Pumpkins for a year. And that's part of it, mm-hmm. obviously. So there's a little jealousy there, too.
And competitiveness. Yeah.
And competitiveness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was interested because you include that letter and then you don't write about it after. Like, you just let it lie there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, and I think, wow, like, do you still consider this person or did, like, is that a friendship?
Yeah, well, we didn't speak for over a decade after I left. And I actually, you know, considering how wild and outspoken that woman is, she actually, that was as harsh as it ever got. And she never spoke badly about me, except for the one time when she said Melissa went off to be Billy Corgan's purse. So that was her deepest cut, her attack on me was, I'm going to be a purse.
But even in that, you basically say, well,
in a way, possibly.
In a minute, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, she was sort of right about a lot, and she really just wanted me to step into my power. And I call Billy and Courtney my grunge parents, and I had cool parents that I had to, like, grow out of their shadows anyway. But then I got these other two parents that really owned me. You know, I went as a bass player in those two mega bands. I was owned by them. And there was a bit of a, when I decided to break free from both of them, there was, you know, a moment where the parents were upset that I left home. But they ultimately, here I am, 2026, they're both supporting the hell out of this book. They're so proud of me. They're yeah. proud of me. They love me. I'm proud of them. We're all thriving. I mean, for Courtney to be alive and thriving and made what I think is one of the best records of her life that's coming out this year, and I sing on that record, and we are there as a female friendship for the ages that shows that even those who go through, you know, war together find each other and are happy to be back in each other's lives. It's a very happy ending. I'm on the Drew Barrymore show this week, and again, all of these people from our generation that went through very dangerous times with themselves. You know, Drew was a child actress,
right.
alcoholic as a child. It feels like happy endings for me. And it feels like our generation, those who made it through and who are thriving at this moment, who have a platform to inspire young people or just our own, you know, Gen X, we're pretty bummed about where the world has arrived. You know, this is exactly what we didn't want. We don't want tech people controlling our lives and making money off of us and controlling our elections and ruining society. That was what we were scared of. And I'm very proud of our Gen X. You know, we were a kind of passive generation in many ways, and the boomers kind of took all the leads. And now I feel like we have our moments where we actually can, like, connect both with the younger world that is wondering to what it was like in the old days, just like you and I might have romanticized the 60s. It's like the 90s is having its moment, and I'm taking advantage of that moment mainly to be an ambassador for the analog world, for my daughter, who I dedicate this book to. She's 14, for the Hudson event that's coming up. I'm having her and her friends be the ones to read from my book. I want to empower the young women of the future generations to consider how they live and consider how their daily relationships and passions are developed, and consider putting your phone down, pick up a guitar, pick up a diary, read a book, be with your friends, be human. They are trying to break down the actual fabric that makes us human. And I am really motivated to just go on this book tour to be an ambassador to humanity and just analog. We can do this. We can get back to a lot of that magic. You can still use your phone for an app for Uber Eats if you really need to, or your banking, but you can live your life, your passionate personal life, in real time and in real life. And I encourage that.
You write about your relationship with Dave Grohl, and
funny segue. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it fits, right? It's yeah. because this
because
is
of the faxes, because of our love faxes.
This is a relationship that yes. that the two of you
It seems like as you're falling in love that this is it. And then you see something. You see some glimpse there that gives you the tap on the shoulder that says, the woman that I want to be, the wife that I want to have, maybe children, maybe not, is not compatible with this human being who I adore.
Love, I know. That's a good point. Thank you for recapping. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a big love and he wanted me to be his wife and so he could go be a huge rock star. And I wanted to do my own things and I didn't want to stay at home. I was never built to be a housewife. And I'm not, you know, no disrespect to every honorable woman who stays home with their children. And as his current wife did, it wasn't for me. And I luckily was not seduced by the deep love and the offering to go on that journey with him. But it was, like sometimes you have to break your own heart to make your future what you need it to be for yourself, you know, because love is irrational. And I am glad for the decisions I have made, but it was hard. And sometimes, I mean, I learned many, many times over in this book and continue to in my life that I don't avoid challenge and I don't avoid hardship to be able to, like, for the greater good, I'm going to just go through the fire. And I left Dave Grohl. I broke up with him.
And you broke up. And then part of the plan is to move to the Hudson Valley. I mean, this coming to this region and Basilica Hudson to be married,
have a real life
and to still have a career. That's it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm so lucky. My 15 years being that I took off from the, you know, entertainment business to invest in our family business, Basilica Hudson, building a tiny little corner of the universe as something that could grow alongside my daughter, you know, our farm and flea markets, our music festivals, our impact of protecting the Hudson waterfront. I turned local. I changed the scale of my life because I wanted to transform as a human because life is short. Why be a rock star forever? That would be limited. I wanted to learn what it was like to live locally and really put my time where I lived. And that's what I've done for 15 years with Basilica and for my daughter. And now that my daughter is reaching a certain age and Basilica can go on without me and Tony being the janitors and the promoters. And we've partnered with an amazing promotion company, Bowery Presents, that are taking over the music events. We have Farm and Flea. We still get to be that, but I get to return as an artist. I'm about to go on a book tour for months. My daughter's proud of me. My daughter's not a two-year-old who will miss her mother. My daughter is rooting for me. And so all of this were big decisions I made to make sure I could have my life and my creative career and give back to young artists. And I feel so fortunate that I got to have this next chapter already. You know, this book has been very well received. I'm like floored by the amount of support that the bass player gets for her memoir already. And it's only just begun. And I get to come out as an author at the age of 54 and start a new chapter of my life because I loved writing this book. I want to write another one.
I was talking just the other day to a very famous comedian who just wrote a book, and obviously he didn't write it.
Well, that's another thing.
And
I found out I wrote
it. You wrote it. And you can tell on every page that you wrote it.
I'm glad that you know that because there's another guy from the 90s, Evan Dano from the Lemonheads. I ran into him recently and he said, I hear you have a memoir. Did you read it? I said, read it? I wrote it. And then I found out, I went back to my agents and I said, wait a second, is this something? They said, okay, yeah, most memoirs are not written. And I said, are people going to think I didn't write this? Because I spent 2 solid years writing this. And they said, no, you can tell. There's no way someone could have ghostwritten this because I bring them into so many wild directions. And you've talked to me, so you know how I talk, but I'm talking like that in the book.
Right.
And it's very layered. And I've been assured that the length of it, because it's quite long, a lot of memoirs are quite small, like thin.
Yeah, I could have taken another 200 pages, but that's
all right. I wrote 200 pages and I had to cut it out. I had to cut 200 pages out, exactly.
Well, I don't want to end before I say that I read this book when it was early in Galley, and then I read it, and then I listened to it. And today marks the day that it will also be released
in an audio form. You read it. It is so emotional.
I mean, I was saying when I walked out of that 8 days of a booth of reading myself to myself.
Yes.
The first thing I thought was, oh, I thought the hard part was going to be writing it. And then once I read it, I would be done. I had no idea that reading it would be harder than writing it. It was so emotional. I like met myself, you know, because I was out of the journey. I had already handed it in so long ago. And I read it and I could not for the life of me get through certain. I cried in places I had no idea I was going to cry.
Well, especially dealing with your father,
yes,
writing about your father and your father's death.
Yes, and but like even other parts of the book, I surprised myself, and a lot of it was like a loss of innocence, tears of realizing, wow, I went through a lot of stuff at too young of an age, and then with the father part, I mean, I know I took break after break, and by the time the audio engineers were crying, and they just said, we're just keeping this. There's no way I could not read certain passages without crying, and it's yes, I actually don't think I'll be listening to that audiobook, but I'm happy I gave it to others who could feel it with me.
You do feel it. I mean, I guess that's exactly the point, is you so much feel it and what you've gone through. You read that on the page, but also to hear it in your voice is really stunning.
Thank you.
Now what?
Well, book tour is epic. I will come back in the fall to talk to you about book number two, which is my 90s rock photography book.
I'm very excited about that.
So that comes out in the fall. It goes to print this week.
I just saw a catalog entry for that. It looks beautiful.
Exactly. And that's going to be partnering with the museum exhibit. It's opening in Toronto, and it's going to be traveling internationally, this exhibit, for years to come. And that's going to be my vehicle of continuing this analog ambassador role where I go on book tours and museum tours. And once I've done that, I want to write book number two, which will be Sneak Peek, Hudson Valley, Become a Mother, Old Factory on the River. I need to sort of get this 90s out of me for the next few years. And then I cannot wait to sit by the fire with my cat and write book number two in a few years from now. I just want to, I can't wait.
On your birthday, you have given us all an amazing gift. This, I think the world is a better place with this book in it.
Oh, thank you.
And to be able to read this story and to understand in such an even, open, beautiful way. I can't thank you enough. You're an absolute delight to talk to, and I so appreciate your honesty and your sharing and being with us and for the gorgeous art that you've put into the world.
Thank you. I'm grateful for WAMC, and I'm grateful for NPR, and I'm grateful for people like you and your team, Sarah. Like, we need to keep this alive, just like we need to keep the fiber of our humanity and analog existence alive. So thank you.
You think we'll get through all this?
I mean, yes, our spirits will, but this is a rough patch.
Melissa Aftabar is our guest. Even the Good Girls Will Cry is the name of the book, a 90s rock memoir. There is going to be a launch event Thursday, March 19th at Basilica Hudson. It's an evening with Melissa Aftabar. You can find out more by going to basilicahudson.org, basilicahudson.org. The book is published by DeCapo Press. Melissa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Be well. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.